Let's go.
Hey, it's Penny Terry here, and on this episode of Hotspots, we're going on a road trip. I'll never forget a friend of mine telling me that as a kid growing up in Georgetown, she was really jealous of her friends with parents who worked at Rio because they got to go to the picnics. And I guess I assumed that it was about the presents she got at the picnics, but after recording this episode, I now know it's about something bigger. This episode is all about how the smelter has helped shape a community.
And I've got newspaper clippings at home which show that, you know, by 1980 there'll be 20,000 people in Georgetown.
This is hardcore serious manufacturing. This isn't, you know, this isn't a hobby, right?
And one day we came out and there were 42 green and gold frogs. And we got very excited.
They were a bit like, oh, they really listened to us. They really wanted to hear what we had to say about our lives. And I'm like, yeah, of course, we've all got value. Our stories are just different.
And the stories you'll hear today will be a bit different as I drove straight through the Bell Bay roundabout and into the community of Georgetown. And here we go.
Hi. Oh. Fancy seeing you walking in the car park here. How are you?
And the first stop, the council chambers with the mayor, Greg Keyser.
Come on through. Welcome to the 1980s. It even smells like the 1980s. You've got to see this carpet. It's absolutely bloody amazing.
Oh, my goodness.
Country comfort from Bathurst circa 1980.
No, only the best for the mayor.
Only the very best.
And after that quick tour of the mayor's office, we soon got on to his first tour of Bell Bay Aluminium.
Well, when you go in there, you very immediately are connected with the reality that this is hardcore serious manufacturing. This isn't, you know, this isn't a hobby, right? These are serious facilities. You know, when you look at the sort of the carbon anodes coming overhead on the conveyor belts, and you go into the pot lines, and you feel the heat of the aluminium, and you know, the very imminent safety concern. That's something that really strikes you. Is, you know, you come in the front gate, and it's, you know, glasses, hard hats, you know, closed shoes, high vis. And for a damn good reason. You know, you go into those into the smelter and you sort of see the things that they're doing on a day-to-day basis, and it becomes abundantly clear straight away why that's the case. You know, it's damn impressive.
And we didn't have to fast forward much before I got a better understanding of what really impressed the mayor.
You know, so for me walking around, I had no real idea of the long legacy of engagement that that smelter has had with this community. And I know that there are numerous projects and initiatives that have been worked on over the years. But for me, in the last 7 years, I've had firsthand experience of, you know, directly of things like, you know, the Bell Bay Advanced Manufacturing Zone and how absolutely pivotal, you know, the smelter is in that, not only from being a core tenant, but also being a founding member and actually keeping that initiative of breathing vitality into the industrial precinct. First-hand experience, obviously, of the work we did together with our mountain biking network. And that's almost like a gold standard example of how public, private, and community can all work together for the greater good. And I think that that has been just a wonderful example of what can be done. I look at things that we're going to be doing in the future. So we're working actively on the shared trail experience. It's a trail we have envisaged that leads from Georgetown all the way up to the lighthouse that narrates the story of our history. And these are all things that I'm delighted to say Bell Bay Aluminium and Rio Tinto have been core partners with us on, both in terms of vision, but also in terms of the brass tacks of funding and collaboratively trying to make these things a reality. But, you know, the key things that strike you when you trying to forge these partnerships is the willingness. You know, some people are reluctant in the way that they engage in these things. But I think in small rural communities, gold standard players lean in and they understand that, you know, it's not just about their welfare and well-being and commercial success. There is a bigger picture. And that is abundantly clear in my interactions with the smelter and with Rio Tinto and Balba Aluminium. I really get a sense that, you know, they are very willing. They're a great partner. They're open to ideas. It's just, it's a wonderful way to do business.
What's an example of what that sounds like or what that action looks like?
Look, I think there are so many things that slip under the radar. I talk about the big initiatives, you know, the large things that you see that are, you know, self-evident and obvious. But there's a strong undercurrent of other small things that make a community tick. But fundamentally, when we need a backer to make our community vibrant and to breathe energy into things that sometimes need initiative and, you know, people who get the bigger picture, you know, I can shamelessly say I've beaten a strong path to Balba Aluminium's door and, you know, and quite frankly, to good effect, because I know that they get it. And, you know, I'm deeply grateful for that interaction.
Sounds like you might have a few people on speed dial.
I do. I do.
Are you a bike rider?
Oh, I certainly am. Although not in recent years.
Yeah, we talked about mountain biking, but what I was really keen to understand is how these partnerships happen.
But really, without the Tipperary Hills and the Tipperary Hills access, you know, it just wouldn't be a thing. And so very early on in the piece, when we had those sort of early indicative designs, we started a conversation and said, hey, look, you know, would you be prepared to be a part of this? It's going to require land access. We're going to need to work together to be able to make this thing work. And, you know, I'm just.
We talked for some time about the process of getting this partnership project up. And then we talked about another partnership project. And then we talked about another partnership project.
The list just goes on and on and on. You know, you invariably find in a little community, you become inseparable. You know, your large industrial tenants, through their engagement and involvement, become part of your community. And again, as I say, you know, without sounding too monotonous here, you know, I'm pretty damn grateful, you know, for the fact that Balba Aluminium are here, and pretty damn grateful for the way that they engage.
So it's 70 years. What do you want to say on the 70th birthday?
To me, the key theme is that you're 70 years young. Now, that may sound like a, you know, a wildly optimistic thought, but I look at the work that Rio Tinto are doing in other parts of the world and what the implications will be for us in a green manufacturing zone, potentially a green manufacturing zone that has got large hydrogen offtake. That's certainly something that I think is in our future. And I look at what is achievable in the global shift to decarbonize, and I see real opportunity. I think that it's an exciting time. I think watch this space. It's going to be a good ride.
And with that, it was time to get the tunes back on, get in my ride, and pretty much just drive around the corner.
And we've arrived.
Stop 2 is the community hub, the library, the Child and Family Learning Centre, a place that has about as many titles as my next guest, Susan Long.
Tell us who you are, what you do here.
I don't know.
Well, I love that question. You choose all of them. I don't mind.
Well, I am employed by Georgetown Council as their Aboriginal Community Engagement Officer. Previously, I was employed with Aboriginal Education for about 6 or 7 years, which is probably where I sort of started having that relationship with Balba Aluminium and Lou Clark, and little projects that we needed support with. They've always been amazing every step of the way, no matter how small or big, actually. So that's fantastic.
I can't wait to get to those stories.
But first, could you tell me a little bit about your story, about your Aboriginal history, your family's history, country here?
Yeah, well, we're on the land of the Leetah and Meerna. There are actually no living descendants of this particular tribe, but my family's Trulaway, so I'm Susan Mansell before I got married. we've got still very strong ties to this community because most of my family, when they first moved back from the islands, came to live in Lefroy, which is not a 5-minute drive out of Georgetown. Quite a large number of our family went to school in Georgetown and then got their first jobs at Kamalco at the time. And then most of the men moved to Launceston. My uncle, Michael Mounce, of course, became a lawyer, and I have got that strong connection. And when I was working for Aboriginal Education at South Georgetown Primary School, I sort of got special permission from the language program to start teaching a little bit of language at the school. And it was an amazing program for all the school to learn place names, flora and fauna, and because that's allowed to be taught to everyone. But obviously Aboriginal language is held much more closely for just communities. So it was a beautiful thing, and we have got probably 4 pieces of artwork around the community with the yarra pulling it on it. So it's being well embraced in our community. And of course now the library's, I think it was the first library to be dual named. So this library here is an amazing supporter of our language and culture as well. So
as I hear you say those words, supporter, embraced, I can't help but wonder how that compares to what it was like for you growing up here.
Oh, yes. I couldn't wait to get married and get rid of my last name. I mean, being a Mansell in this community was, you know, you couldn't hide. Everybody knew an Aboriginal person, even though you were told at grade 6, I could remember being told there were no Aboriginal people, Tasmanian Aboriginal people, and I rang up my father that night and said what I'd been told, and he was just like, it doesn't matter what they teach you, you know who you are, you know who your family are. You know, it's white fellas education, you really, you know. But it was still very hard. We were, another young man who I went to school with in my year, we were both treated differently, absolutely. So we were taught there were no Aboriginal people in Tasmania, but we were ticked off in the system as Aboriginal students, and we were definitely treated less than all the way through school.
Particularly, you said you couldn't hide. Did you want to hide?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You didn't want to be who you were. You wanted to be able to fit in and not be different. It's not an easy space to live in or work in even now. So the difference is massive, and I suppose that's why you keep on at it, because to not have our Aboriginal youth feel that way now, that's the way it should be.
How do they feel now? Do you think? What do you hear?
Oh, look, I only have to send them all a text message when I want them to come to something or be a part of something, and I get yes, 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 straight away from all of them. They're, you know, all of that support from industry and council and community has really helped us all stay really connected, because, you know, you can't really do that without supporting partnerships in the community, because it's a lot for one person to do by themselves.
I've just come from the council and speaking with the mayor. Tell me about how that support from industry, Bell Aluminium, we're celebrating 70 years as part of this podcast. What's that support look like?
They've been really amazing when I've sort of said how important it is for Aboriginal community to feel included, or they've all needed their own sort of cultural. It's a cultural awareness program that TAC tweaked a little bit for Aboriginal community that don't know a lot about themselves or their own history. So Council and Bell Bay Aluminium have paid for that training for community. There's always been one they've had for staff or management. That's been really empowering for them to have that education. So, you know, when we're asked for Aboriginal community to come and contribute to something or come along to something, they are much more willing because they feel more value, because they know that, you know, Council or Bell Bay Aluminium have supported their own journey, which means they're contributing in so many other ways in the community now because of that empowerment they've felt from quite a young age, and that support's, you know, not being disconnected. It's been continued by everybody. So, you know, it's not like a little bit of funding that happens and then it just disappears, and then, you know, you've lost your connections and your relationships in the community. It's been continuous. So that's what's been really important. That support has just keep on continuing every year. And I just think we can't do anything alone as a community. Like, no matter what issues a community has, you know, or even if a community wants to celebrate something, you need partnerships. Like, you can't do it alone. It does take a village to raise a child. And when you've got lots of children in your village, you need lots of partnerships. And the children are always the future of our community. And the more people that support our youth in all their learning, and for them to understand that, you know, the older community value them, the council value them, industry value them, they're more likely to volunteer, you know, all of their life. They're more likely to apply for jobs in the industries that they know, and they've had long-term relationships but ever since they were young. They're not scared of them. When we've had the cooking program and we invited Bellbrae Aluminium to come for the celebration lunch, most of the mothers didn't want to sit down and talk because they were too afraid. And I said, no, I've known these people for a long time. They're just like you and me. But they saw that as a bit of a barrier. You know, they've got really good jobs. They're really well educated. We won't know what to say to them. And I just said, you need to trust me. Like, just sit down and talk and be yourself. They're just normal people too. Like, they wanted to hear your story. They've supported this program. They believe in you. It was the most beautiful thing at the end of it when everyone left and we were cleaning up, and they just said, oh, you were right. They're really lovely. I said, of course they are. They're just normal people like you and me. They, you know.
How big of a step is that?
Huge, huge. Especially for the three of the mothers that we had at that program, they looked different after having the lunch and having a chat with other people. They were a bit like, oh, they really listened to us. They really wanted to hear what we had to say about our lives and our journey. And I'm like, yeah, of course. You've got, you know, we've all got value. Our stories are just different.
Well, let's talk about the story, the cooking program. I'd love to know how it started. Where did the idea come from? How did you get everyone involved? To go back to the start, right. I mean, was there epiphany one day while you were sitting down and talking with someone? What happened?
Yeah, because the education department don't really have the funds to run that sort of program, and we've already got a captured audience, more or less, coming to the CFLC every day.
That's the Child Family Learning Centre.
Yes, yep. It is. Just having fruit on the bench, which we do get $50 worth of fruit from Woolworths every week, but that's not enough. You're noticing that people are sort of maybe hanging around and at lunchtime, and there's, you know, a bit of food insecurity, and we just knew that there was a massive need for education, connection, and more food to be available to our community. So that's when I sort of had a little chat to Bellbrae Aluminium and said, hey, what do you think about running a little pilot program? And I think the most we got out of it was that connections, that relationships that those mothers made with each other, and the confidence they feel now about coming in and contributing more and being part of, like, other groups, other programs.
If you had to list the benefits...
Yeah. Well, we obviously expect them to have at least one healthy meal a week, to be able to teach them something about food preparation or budgeting, hygiene in the kitchen, trying different food from different cultures. Sometimes I've thrown in a few indigenous ingredients, which I do quite regularly anyway, which they've...
Like what?
Oh, like, you know, if we're doing something with chocolate or coffee, throw some wattle seed in there, or some lemon myrtle into like a lemon cake or a dish that's, you know, has that sort of flavour. But the friendships were the surprise, and how the way they interact in the CFLC now. It's just so good to have, when you have industry or businesses, councils that are really involved in their community and want to do anything they can to support something that seems so small to most people when you describe a cooking program. It's when you dig down deeper, the knock-on effects of a program like that is massive, and you can't really advertise that, and you can't sometimes even describe it, because it's, you know, it's the connections we make and the services we might refer people onto, but without support we really can't achieve it alone. It's it can be opportunities that are missed, and you know that if you can make a connection with somebody somehow, with the support of someone like Bellbrae Aluminium, you really can change a life. You really can.
Doesn't get much bigger than that. That's Susan Long, wearer of many hats in the Georgetown community. And the changing lives, saving lives theme continued when I arrived at Stop 3.
Getting directions to Georgetown Fire Station.
I probably don't need directions.
Starting route to Georgetown Fire Station.
But it was fun to ask.
At the roundabout, take the first exit onto Goulburn Street.
Be here. There's no editing in that. That's literally how
the destination is on your right, Georgetown Fire Station. Arrived.
Hi. Hello. I'm looking for Andrew Taylor.
You are.
Ah, how are you?
Penny.
Penny, nice to meet you.
You too.
How long have you been hanging out here for?
We're started, by the way. I'm just going to get straight into it.
Oh, you are not. 41 years this year.
Right.
25 as brigade chief and was it 15 years as unit manager for SES as well.
So volunteer, fire brigade?
Yeah, all volunteer. Volunteer fire brigade, volunteer SES. We've got 34 members for TFS and 14 SES. And we do road crash rescue all the way up to pretty much Hillwood, just past, yeah.
Seen some pretty tough stuff.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, and I did 25 years ambulance volunteering before that. But I thought I was probably doing enough, so I decided to pull the pin on that. Yeah, look, the guys and girls have seen lots of stuff. We can't go a kilometre without having been to fatalities and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, some pretty nasty stuff.
What does that mean when you're from a community and you're seeing that stuff in a community?
I don't know. There's just a resilience you build up, but you often know the people as well, so that's tougher, and particularly when it's young people. It gets very tough, and you don't get away from it because if you don't know that person, you know someone that knows that person. So it is tough for the Vols, but, you know, we've got great systems in place now compared to years ago, lots of support and health and wellbeing stuff. So, yeah, it is tough for the Vols. It is.
We're here to talk about Bell Bay Aluminium in Rio and the impact on the community. But, you know, maybe this is part of it, that idea that when you are working in a community, you're living in a community, you're volunteering in a community, everything's sort of intertwined.
Yeah, totally. And look, the industries in Bell Bay have been huge support directly and indirectly to the emergency services and the volunteers. Because we are all volunteers, so there's one paramedic, the rest are all volunteers. There's all volunteer fire and SES. So industry, indirect and direct, by allowing them to come to incidents, by allowing them to come to jobs, and if we've got a significant job, they release their people. And that's just invaluable because otherwise you've got a core group of people, some like old people like me that are semi-retired.
You're still saying semi-retired. You don't know what to say.
I think I'm busier now than I ever was, quite frankly. And if you talk to my wife, she'd say that. But, yeah, look, I think that's what makes small towns work is the community. And where there are larger employers, I think it's taken for granted what they invest in their people. So, you know, I've got probably six or seven from Rio that are here. And, you know, last night we did training. We rolled out at 7 o'clock last night, freezing cold night. We used one of their old facilities to do BA training. We were testing ourselves on BA comms. And so we were able to do that at a facility like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the guys that was running the training for me, my second officer, Ricky Hill, just got permissions and all the rest of it through Richard and the team at Rio to be able to run that training. So, you know, it's hard to explain the investment that they put into the likes of us as much as we work with them.
Let's walk out here the front because I'm wondering, and this might be a stupid non-local question, can we actually see, maybe not the smelter from here, look at me, I'm walking right out on the street. What do you remember as a kid maybe?
Look, this place has changed remarkably. I'm all of 62 years of age now, virtually growing up all my life here. We were built back in the, you know, 40s and 50s as a fishing village. And then when the Rio turned up, I mean, my uncle and aunt, my uncle worked out there, came out as one of the originals. And I've got newspaper clippings at home which show that, you know, by 1980 there'll be 20,000 people in Georgetown. You know, it's quite funny to reflect on some of the stories that were coming out as Comalco, Kaiser Aluminium, as it was then, being built, what it was going to look like. Yeah, it was incredible.
What do you remember about those early days and the hype, the talk, what you'd learn from having family members involved in, I guess, a new entity?
as we just walk through the fire station here?
Well, you know, what they used to do also was when I was at school, we actually had... warmer in here.
That's
better, they had cards and they had all the raw material products, so you could do school projects.
Okay. So what do you mean cards?
Like an A3 type card with little bits of bauxite, little bits of alumina, and it had their process flow on a card, which was absolutely brilliant because, you know, we didn't know. There's a mystique with industry generally because you don't get into it, you don't get to see it. You can only go off what people tell you. And, you know, my dad worked there, my uncles worked there. So you got these little cards and it was, you know, it was huge back in those, like a show bag, and you could see what this aluminium looked like and what this stuff was. And we'd do school projects at school. It was part of the way of doing business back in those days. Yeah, no, it was quite incredible. And the things that we got when our parents were there, you know, like the SIBO picnics. It was part of being, you know, a little one. You go down the street with your parents, you went to the Memorial Hall, you picked up your present, then there'd be a beach party, and there were hundreds of us there.
What do you mean presents? Was it around Christmas?
Yeah, around Christmas. Christmas presents for all the children.
Of the employees?
Of the employees. Direct employees got, you know, and there were hundreds of presents around the Memorial Hall, like different age groups, and you went in with your ticket and you got your present, away you went. It was quite incredible, just incredible.
Yes, we found ourselves deep in an accidental history conversation, which quickly moved from how the community felt about those employee picnics to how the community felt about employee opportunity.
Look, I think if we reflect on, you know, the 80s, and I probably wasn't as well-versed or researched in what industry and what the global economy was looking like back in those days, I think growth was phenomenal back in those 60s, 70s. We were coming through from the Second World War. We had a massive labour shortage. You know, lots of people came from Britain, particularly Scotland, which is where my family came from. And as a result of that, there was this anticipation within the country that we were just going to grow and grow and grow. Tasmania, funny thing, three things what brought industry to Tasmania were stable government, deep sea water port. There's lots deeper, but they've all been dredged, and power. So, you know, Eric Reese and the launch of power into this state then gave such intense industries like Rio and BHP back in the day the opportunity to come here because they were getting power at prices that no one else in the world could get. But we also weren't a world market as much as we are today. So in those original predictions, it was the local economy we were supplying, so the steel industry, the aluminium industry in Australia. But, of course, that's changed, as we know. And so the realisation from the 70s and 80s to now, you know, as 80s came in, had a fair old bit of a depression type, mini depression. So, you know, retrenchments were in, you know, that's just how it sort of started. And then it sort of just stabilised since then. So the growth.
We could have gone on for hours, and actually we kind of did. But I do just want to fast forward to some more recent history and a different hat Andrew Taylor wears as the chair of the Future Impact Group and how that all started.
We had no idea what we were going to do. We just not long built the community hub, and the brand new manager for that place was a lady that was very visionary and way in front of her time if we reflect on it. And she, along with Anne Cameron and Lou and I, probably got together as a group of four and thought, well, here's this thing called collective impact. The government's sort of doing a bit of funding on this. And there are a couple of examples, one on the mainland in Victoria and one in Burnie. Why can't we duplicate that? And the system was to sort of make and streamline processes for some of our lower socioeconomic people, but also for those that were at risk. So that took us, look, I don't know how many meetings we had, and we thought through and procrastinated for some time, and it realised into a in some workshops and then involving other people, and it's just gone on and on from there. And it's been an invaluable experience. And from day one, you know, the smelter invested, both personally with people, but also with dollars, when we didn't have a backbone. We, you know, the backbone is the overarching organisation that might fund or look after such an organisation. Council wanted to be involved, you know, the CFLC, the hub wanted to be involved, other industry wanted to be involved, but we didn't know what we're getting involved in. But this is where Lou so often puts a foot in where no one else will have a dip and convinces her team to say, right, there's something in this, let's work with this. We had a workshop. We had over 100 people in the hall. We got their community voices. We collected over 500 voices to sort of understand what were the things that were impacting or affecting or perceptions, because at the end of the day, that's reality. So how do we then turn that around into doing something to help our people and help our community? And that realised into a whole suite of things that have happened, you know, the launch pad, which is an amazing facility.
And Andrew started telling me all about these programs, from the launch pad to the Youth Impact Council Seagulls for Chips and so many other initiatives that were focused on things like
community pride, community health and employment.
And the impact?
Yeah, there's a couple of individuals in the launch that were part of the launch pad program back in the day. And these were women that had never had employment, very tough family circumstance. Really didn't see value, and, you know, I was struggling day to day, really was getting through day to day. Participated in that program, did a level 2 certificate, then went and did some more training, has got a job, and is screaming from the rooftops. Just can't believe what life is like. But that person didn't know what they were doing from one day to the next, didn't know whether they were getting a dollar other than, you know, Centrelink type payments. And never had a job. But now she sees she wants to go and do some more training. She's actually doing more training through TAFE and Cert 2, Cert 3. You know, unless you're in that space and observe it and you have that story told to you, you don't realise how powerful that is.
I can see that in your eyes. Being part of some of these programs, even though you've lived in this community nearly all of your life, what have you learned?
I think it's creating the opportunities. And I think the biggest learning for me is to create those opportunities and enable those opportunities. I might have a perception about what that community needs or those individuals need, but it's empowering. It's giving them some data. It's giving them some information. And it's then giving them the opportunity to grow. And I think if we do reflect and we really listen to the subtlety of the message that's coming through, then we'll have a much better community that's an empowered community and one that we communicate with, not at. And that's so powerful.
Thank you. Really enjoyed the chat today.
Thanks, Penny. Cheers.
And with that, it was time for me to get back in the car and go a bit further afield and see some of the other impacts that Bell Bay Aluminium Rio has had on this town.
Arrived.
Thank you, Siri. So helpful. Oh my goodness me. Oh my gosh. Wow.
So I've arrived at the Low Head Community Garden.
Let's go find Joe.
I didn't find Joe Hart straight away, but I did find someone else.
I'm a support worker, and so I bring out my clients out here.
Yeah.
And just so I pay the $20 a year, I think it is, or 20, whatever it is, to become a member. I don't have a garden plot, but I love bringing my clients out here because they can walk around and pick some flowers if they want and just walk around the gardens. It's absolutely beautiful. So when I say clients, with disabilities and inabilities, depending on there's mental issues or there's disability issues and illnesses, that they just come out and it's so peaceful.
Yeah.
It's so, and then I just came out
as I kept chatting with Narelle, the community support worker, I could instantly understand how this community garden was having an impact, and I hadn't even started the tour yet.
Hi, so good. I'm blown away.
So this is Jo Hart. She is my garden tour guide, but has also been part of the Future Impact Group and is the driving force behind many community initiatives like the Low Head Community Garden.
Jo, how long has this been here for? We started in 2022 and realised that there was this vacant area here. We ran a series of kitchen tables meetings, and what people said that they wanted was an area that they could come to anytime, that was a community space, that it was a meeting space, it was a happy space. And so that was the idea. So we started off, and we'll come over to
take me for a tour.
Okay,
you lead the way.
Start over here. We've been fortunate with some fantastic partners here, and we have the most phenomenal head gardener, Kathy, who lives over there.
Oh, fantastic.
She's extremely talented, but she's also got the ability to bring people. Normally, we have once a month working bees, and we normally have 30 people turn up.
Wow, that's a sign of successful community buy-in and engagement, right? Yes.
So this is our, this is what we called stage one. We wanted these raised beds so that people, older people, could sit on them to garden. And so we started off with a partnership with the East Tamar Men's Shed. And a lovely man, John and Kathy, made these designs. And then John went and got all his team up at Dilston and built them. Then when we were children down here over on Lagoon Beach, were beach houses, like St Kilda Beach. So we decided we'd have some little sheds that would be reflective of the beach houses, and different people donated them. So these two here, Bessie and Harty, they're my parents. Dad loved flags, so that's why there's flags. Mum loved garden books, that's why there's Bessie's got garden books.
So if we look around here, I'll just explain, Joe, dotted all around this garden, you can't miss them. It's the first thing you notice when you come in are these little sheds that look like the beach houses from St Kilda, or as you're saying, we're just Lagoon down the way here at Lagoon Beach. And each of them has a name on them, and then they have a sign because of what that person was into. Is it also what's in there?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. So, so
Peter Kundal.
And this was just before Peter, we opened just before Peter died. And we actually asked Peter to come over and open it because he lives just on the other side of the river, or he did. And unfortunately, he said he was in, he wrote us this beautiful letter in copper plate handwriting and said, no, unfortunately, he couldn't. But he sent us the Peter Kundal pumpkins and his notes on what to grow in the Tamar Valley.
Wow, so, that is a special gift.
So that was such a special gift, and we're still growing the Peter Kundal pumpkins. Oh. But we've got a number of traditions that we've started here that are really great. So all along here, now you can't see them at the moment because unfortunately the crops failed this year.
No one can see that, Josh.
We grow red poppies and then take them around Georgetown on the 11th of the 11th.
As we wandered around the garden, Joe explained how that place and these projects bring together people from right across the community, young people, old people, visitors, and even some unexpected guests.
Kathy put in one pond, and that was in a wet spring. And one day we came out and there were 42 green and gold frogs sitting around the rim of the pond, and we got very excited.
And what happens when you get excited, Joe? Like, obviously this whole thing, but what else?
Well, people came out of the woodwork with their old ponds or their new ponds. They'd been to Bunnings and bought a new pond and donated it. If we have rain, it's full of frogs. And then we have kids and grandparents who bring their kids to come and see the frogs. Because there's not a lot of places where you can go to reliably see a frog.
It's true. Never thought about it before, but it's true.
And the fact that they are endangered in the wild is fantastic.
Wow. How much learning has there been for you, Joe?
Just a huge amount of learning, but it's also learning about people. Okay. And so there's this guy who used to walk past every day with his dog. Gradually started coming closer, started talking to people over the fence into the garden. Now that guy, that man, he's in charge of rubbish. He's in charge of the sprinkler heads. He manages the keys and some of the locking up, and is absolutely integral and invaluable. He had been recently widowed, and I love to just see that for people who have been living reasonably isolated, lonely lives, that there's an opportunity for a great big community, and here we are. Mm. And the fact that we've got something here that everyone's proud of, that's great.
How do you see that pride?
I love it when you hear, I just wanted to show my visitors, oh, I've been to a garden on the mainland, but, you know, it wasn't nearly as good as our garden.
They're showing off. I love it.
That's love it. But the fact that they've come and they are, you know, they're really proud.
The tour continued because there is so much to see. And then we ended up at another special spot.
There's so much stuff to look at.
Yeah. What's down here?
Well, we wanted a seating area so we get garden clubs and school groups, people from nursing homes. So we wanted somewhere that was okay for people to sit. We've also had a citizenship ceremony here, which was lovely. So this was a Bilbao Aluminium grant to create a yarning circle. We consulted with local Aboriginal people. But around we've grown all things that are edible. Wow. So this side here is Morris, is some Australian but mostly native edibles. And over this side are Tasmanian edibles. Incredible. So like these are kangaroo apples. This is Tasmanian native cress. Winter cress.
Well, you can tell, can't you, actually?
Yeah, so I've actually made that into pesto.
Oh, amazing.
Mm, which we've had in our community garden afternoon teas, which we have, as you do. This is a lovely area. Now, let's go up here to the glasshouse.
This episode in the podcast is about the connection that Bilbao Aluminium, Rio, Comalco has with the community. When you look around this garden, you know, what comes to mind for you about that connection?
Well, a number of things. One is how fortunate we have been to receive some funding that have enabled us to do significant projects like the Yarning Circle when you need, you know, like we've probably got $3,000 of gravel. You know, that's a lot of $5 plants to sell. Yeah. So things like that that have been really valuable. But what has been great now, this is a place when Bilbao have interstate or overseas visitors. They come and we've had a number of occasions where we've had afternoon tea in the garden, and it's a different space for them to see outside the boardroom in Bilbao.
What? Why is that important? What's your take on that?
That it shows community. Yeah, you know, it's quite hard to take visitors to somewhere where it is their dollars being actively used. I hear stories that in many places you've got an industry and you've got community, and the industry people don't live in the community. They don't understand what the community needs, and they just dole out money. Here there is constant dialogue and there is such connection in every family. And it is so the two are not separate.
I've certainly felt that as I've spoken with people today. Mm. Jo, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Penny.
Well, what a trip. We've heard about yarning circles and new jobs, cooking programs and bike tracks, but as I learned today, the impact that Bilbao Aluminium, Rio, has had on this municipality over its 70 years runs deeper than any of that. And maybe by listening to this episode, you've learned about some of that depth, or maybe you've been reminded. And next week, we'll be reminded again as we take a look at how the smelter gets into families.
Didn't really have any idea what Mum did at work. And it's even now when people ask me what I do there, it's quite hard to explain.
Did you give her a pep talk?
No. I'm like, you'll be right. You'll be right.
No 101.
You'll be right.
When people say, you know, what do you do there? And we pretty much just say, well, I break it and he fixes it. So, and it keeps us both in our jobs.
Next episode, we'll hear what it's like to work with someone else in your family at the smelter. My name's Penny Terry. This is Hotspots, celebrating 70 years of the aluminium smelter at Bilbao. So back in the car for me, until next episode.
Starting route to Launceston, Tamar and the North. At the roundabout, take the first exit.